Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do you feel about your body? Assuming you are reasonably healthy, it carries you into the world, allows you to work and live independently, and offers the pleasures of sensation and human touch. But many of us in the modern world seem to be at war with our bodies, disappointed by their size, embarrassed by their shape, and either obsessed with remaking them or resigned to feeling ashamed of them. Such thinking can be exceptionally harmful, my guest today argues, but it is not inevitable. Susie Orbach is a psychotherapist and co-founder of the Women's Therapy Centers in New York and London. She has treated thousands of patients for body image disorders, including the late Princess Diana, and has continued to write after her landmark book, Fat is a Feminist Issue, was published more than 30 years ago. Her newest book is called Bodies. Susie, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Hello.
Why is it so hard for us to be happy with our bodies?
Well, I think we've got a complete madness going on in our culture where we're assailed from every possible direction, whether it's from visual culture where we see images of digitally perfected bodies that actually don't exist in the real world, and we see thousands of those images every week, so many that nobody can count them, not even the advertisers who depend on them. Then the food industry who's divides up and segments our food into so many different kinds of categories, from gourmet foods to high-fat foods to low-fat foods to healthy foods to basic foods to low-glycemic, to, you know, et cetera, to an obsession with dieting because the diet industry makes so much money by, on the basis of making us feel that we're all too large and failing to deliver the product that they offer, et cetera, so that we have a kind of sense of the body as being the place both of self-expression, but also a place of that we can transform and should transform and should be the place that we are empowering ourselves from and signaling who we are and building our identity around. It's become a very, very shaky place.
I think it's fascinating. One of the things that you talk about is this idea that we don't really use our bodies to make things anymore. Mm. And so we turn the focus for creation onto our bodies themselves.
Mm, yes. In a way, it's as though we've become enslaved by the notion that our bodies should be our product. And whether that's, I mean, I'm in New York now, and I've been really very interested in the fact that people don't think aging is an okay situation, or the ordinary processes of the bodies should not exist, that one should efface wrinkles, one should efface faces, one should work on one's body to produce it as a calling card rather than as a place to live from.
Do we tend to believe that beauty is earned, or is it something that we think we deserve?
I think that's really interesting, because I think beauty used to be a kind of category in that beauty's represented our culture for us, right? Just like the greatest boxer in the world was the greatest boxer in the world. We didn't all expect to be the greatest boxer. But in a way, beauty has now been democratized, and we are invited, beguiled, captivated by the notion that beauty is an important category that we can all be part of, and that we should be part of, and that we should aspire to, and that we need to know what its parameters are by the time we're six, and we can never give up knowing those, even if we're 75 and in an old person's home. So your question about whether it's a given or it's a creation is an interesting one. I think we're kind of teetering between the notion that we have to earn it, we have to create it, and we're showing how good we are if we achieve it, because otherwise, what on earth are all those snarky magazines that show celebrities who represent beauty for us when they look ordinary? What they're showing is, oh my God, they've let the side down. They haven't done their work. So earning it is an important piece of the story, right? People no longer ashamed of cosmetic surgery. It's a kind of site of empowerment, isn't it? I've done this, I've had work done, I've done this, I've had that, as though one has been heroic, one has been through the wars, and one has come out the other side with the perfect goods.
And do you think that we apply different standards of what is beautiful and acceptable to other people than we apply to ourselves?
That's a good one, too. don't we? I think in general we tend to find other people acceptable and enjoy them because we don't see their faces or bodies as passive or fixed, right? When you're talking to a friend, you see their vibrancy or you see their sadness or you see their anguish or you see their interest or you and you see them moving. When we see a picture of ourselves, we're in the mirror. And you, when you start moving, you can't actually see yourself. So I think we're far more critical of ourselves than we are of other people, except when they are the celebrities who have come to represent beauty for us. Then I think we do go very snarky.
Why is it that you think we reject what we see as ugly? Or not even ugly, but not beautiful?
Well, I think there's an interesting process that occurs by which if you see thousands and thousands of images, you begin to look at yourself from the perspective of those images, and you feel that you wish to emulate them. I mean, it's a very, very simple process. We know it in terms of food or furniture or fashion and all sorts of things. Something new comes on, a look. It doesn't have to be the skeletal look, or it doesn't have to be somebody with a bizarre hairstyle. Doesn't really matter what it is. And our initial response, I think, is, I'm not sure about that. And it may even be a kind of rejection or revulsion of that. And then you see it again, and you see it again, and you see it again, and you're kind of interested. You look out for it. And then you kind of get really interested in it and think, maybe I'd like to have that. And in the process of the, I might like to be part of that, I'd like to have that new furniture, that new kind of look, that new kind of food, you begin to think of yourself as old-fashioned and in need of updating. And it's then that the experience of self-criticism happens at the same time as the desire for transformation occurs. So you both want what's there, but it's also driven by a feeling of I'm not all right as I am, of inadequacy.
You also write about the fact that there never has been in sort of modern history a natural looking body that was viewed as ideal. We've always looked to the culture to define what's right.
Yeah, I don't even know if we have a body outside of culture. I know that sounds like a mad idea, but we've always taken the body for granted. And there is, in a way, no such thing as a naturalistic body, right? If we grew up in China, and we were Western, but we were raised by Chinese parents. Okay, that's not the norm. It's usually the other way around. We would walk, talk, gesticulate, our jaw muscles, everything about us, the sounds that we emit, the way we dealt with our private functions, the delicacy with which we ate, etc., would conform to Chinese culture, just as a Chinese baby raised in New York City by Western parents. She may have the facial characteristics of a Chinese baby, but she will have the voice and the gait and the movement and the other physical movements that are associated with a Western body. So bodies are always made in a cultural setting. And in fact, if you don't grow up with other bodies, you don't necessarily have a body that looks like a human body. The wild child in France from the late 1700s who grew up in the woods didn't actually walk on 2 feet. He walked on all fours, and he mimicked the animals that he grew up with. He also didn't have clothing, and his body temperature, he'd learned to regulate it through, I don't know, of course, how this happened, but he didn't want clothing. His skin had become almost like an animal's fur, not in how it looked, but in its capacity to regulate the harsh extremes of temperature. So everything we know about our body is something that is given us and that is that we then enact in our journey through life and has the expression of our particular cultural moment in it.
Yeah, in addition to the wild child story, Susie, you had case studies in the book of patients whose issues would seem to lie far outside the typical ones that we think of in terms of mm-hmm. our bodies, for example, weight. Can you talk about what we can learn from these really extreme examples about the way our own thinking can be disordered?
Well, I think this has always been psychoanalysis's methodology, is that it looks at a particular story in depth, and from it shows you how our minds work. And that has really been psychoanalysis's story. And if you ever read any case histories, whether Freud's or more contemporary ones, you always identify with the patients or the characters in the case story. What I wanted to do was look at the body, because I think that's been left out of psychoanalysis except as a kind of bit player to the main feature, which is the mind, and say, okay, let's look at these extreme body stories. What are they telling us about our own body difficulties, the ordinary nature of the body? What can we learn about body integrity through looking at some unusual body distortions or body imagining? So I have a case of somebody who won't be touched, but a child who's been brought up in a foster home and then is taken up by a long-term foster parent, and she really hasn't been touched very much, but she finds a mechanism by which she will let her mother touch her, her new mother, foster mother touch her, first at one remove by asking for a very, very elaborate hairstyle, during which they have to spend an hour every single day doing that hairstyle, as a way of her finding a body sense of herself in this new relationship and entering into her body, rather than using her body as a place to tattoo or to market or to hurt herself. You know, there's another story of somebody who wanted to do away with many of his limbs because he didn't feel that they were part of him. He felt that they were surplus to requirements. He felt he'd only have body integrity if he could do away with them. That tells us something about that notion of the body, which is far more personal than just the unfolding of a particular DNA sequence. It tells us that how you experience your body has a lot to do with how you were treated, how you perceived bodies around you, and the kind of feeling and emotional ambiance around the bodies of your family and the people you were growing up with.
You know, Susie, what's so interesting about that is that we do now sort of commonly accept that stress and different things can contribute to physical ailments, but we don't look at it very often the other way around.
Correct. And that is really what this book is trying to do. And I think I could have written a lot more about that, but it's a very short book, so I couldn't. But I think we've now got such body anxieties and such destabilized bodies that is, in fact, affecting our minds. It is a two-way street. It is not simply a one-way street at all. And often we misunderstand a symptom like eczema because we think of it as being about stress in the mind, which, of course, it may very well be. But it may also be telling us that this is about the difficulty of this body having been well-received, this body being in a certain kind of torment, this body weeping, and that the body itself needs attention. I think of this particularly in relation to anorexia, because you will hear people saying, well, she's so tortured, she's so controlling, she has to do away with her body. Yes, that may be what's going on at one level, but at another level, that body is such a frightened body that it's had to create an alternative body it can admire. And the various, you know, which is this very emaciated body, out of the very body she has, because the body she has, she feels so uncomfortable with. And many of the things she will do, like run up and downstairs 100 times or go to the gym for hours or not eat this, force her to be engaged with the body all the time, forcing her to pay attention to something that doesn't quite exist yet, because really, in a way, it's never come to life.
Susie Orbach is my guest. She's a psychotherapist and co-founder of the Women's Therapy Centers in London and in New York. Her new book is called Bodies. We'll return in a moment to take your calls. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is psychotherapist Susie Orbach. She's a co-founder of the Women's Therapy Centers in London and in New York. Her new book is called Bodies. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. Susie, how often are people whose bodies look perfect just as distressed as those who fall far short of the ideal?
Well, Chris, I think it's a very important point because I think what happens in most public health policy is the focus is on people who express body difficulties that you can see. But the vast majority of body difficulties you cannot see at all. They are people walking around who feel uncomfortable, who are fretting from the minute they wake up, and but who pass in a way, who look like they're perfectly content. And who just throw in the odd remark about, of course, I'm on this diet, and then I'm going to do this, thinking of that. But it's so much part of the patois that one doesn't actually think of it as a tip-off to trouble. And in fact, with many patients, I mean, I'm a general psychoanalyst, psychotherapist, so I see people who come in ostensibly with the ordinary problems of loss, lack of confidence, difficulties in relationships, trouble with kids, whatever, trouble in, you know, their marriages. And in fact, I like to keep to a very small number the number of people who explicitly come in with eating problems. And inevitably during therapy, whoever it is will pass a remark about their body in which I'm invited to agree with them that there is something wrong about their body that they need to change. So everybody, it seems to me, is walking, okay, everybody I see in therapy, and they're not coming to me because they know I do body stuff, because I've written more books about non-body stuff than I have about bodies. They expecting assent for the idea that there is something wrong with their bodies. And that is a very troubling thought, that the ordinary activities of life are accompanied by distress about the body.
Are you convinced that that was not the case, say, 100 years ago?
Yeah. Absolutely. No, this is completely new finding of mine and my colleagues in the last 10 to 15 years at this level of difficulty. You know, originally if somebody came in and they weren't talking about body difficulties after I wrote that as a feminist issue, and then they suddenly switched to body difficulties, I used to think to myself, are they talking about that because they think that's going to interest me more? You know, do they have eating difficulties because they think that's going to capture me in a way that I haven't been particularly attentive? Of course, you know. And that may have been true then, but it only ever happened very occasionally. Now, I don't think it's because they're hoping to capture or captivate or interest me. I think it's simply because they take for granted that being troubled about your body is just part of life. It's like, you know, being worried about whether you have enough money for your kids' education. It's the same kind of order of business. It's an ordinary, everyday, acceptable complaint.
Do you think the way people talk about it now so openly reflects a fear on their part that others see them as unacceptable as well?
Oh, yeah. I think people will talk about it before. I mean, it used to be that if you were fat, you'd have to apologize or you'd have to joke about it, right? Now, you have to be talking about, just listen to a bunch of teenage girls or overhear any conversation in a restaurant or on the subway. Well, I know you don't have subways out there, do you?
We've got trains.
We've got trains. There is always a conversation piece about I should or I shouldn't or this or that or I need to change. So it's both to anticipate criticism, but it's also because it is part of how we express so much about our lives is through our bodies today.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Susie Orbach is here. Her latest book is called Bodies. Let's go to Plano and speak with Ken. Hi, Ken.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to quickly share an experience that dovetails perfectly with this topic. About 4 years ago, I went from 225 pounds to 125 pounds, and I'm 5'7". I'm not doing this to brag, but I did what I think most people really want to do, which is take off body fat and get into pretty good shape. But what's fascinating about what happened to me was I didn't know. I got down to 120 pounds, which for my size is pretty light for my size, and I absolutely had no idea how a male should look.
Mm-hmm.
I realized that my view of male bodies was distorted because I didn't like what I saw. I went to my doctor, and amazingly, he didn't know either. He really didn't.
That's absolutely fascinating, really.
Yeah, I mean, that's that. And he sent me to a nutritionist, and my nutritionist had a general idea, I suppose, about how a 40-year-old male should look. You know what he said to me? He said, pick an actor and emulate that actor. So I said, okay, I mean, what if I pick Arnold Schwarzenegger? I mean, you know, thank gosh I don't have an eating problem. You know, I didn't have any emotional problems that led to an eating disorder. But, you know, he said, pick an actor. So I picked an actor who was sort of bald like me, who was sort of my size, named Ed Harris.
Yeah, so, he's gorgeous.
Well, the idea was to pick his body.
I mean, I find this absolutely shocking.
So my question is, in all of this, and this I've told a lot of my friends who admire what I've done, I don't know what advice to give people about what do you tell people about what their body should look like, because it was not, and it still isn't obvious to me 4 years later, what I should or should not be looking like because of the influence of media images. Matthew McConaughey with his shirt off all the time. Thank you very much, and I look forward to hearing your answer.
But wait a minute. Tell me, how do you feel in this body now, the body that you are inhabiting?
Well, you know, the funny thing about it is what people don't understand who admire what I've done is I have the same problem that I've had before, I had before, which is I have to manage cravings and eating problems. I've got a weight problem, even though I'm 125 pounds.
Of course.
And people don't really understand that. How do I feel? Well, the answer is, and we're getting into psychological issues, I hate myself less.
Mm-hmm.
That's the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, losing weight, getting to a certain size, doesn't automatically mean that you feel better about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
It really doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And those are deeper psychological
mm-hmm.
issues.
Mm-hmm.
Always. They always are.
Mm-hmm.
So I hate to tell this to people who are out there who really, when they watch these TV shows like Dr. Phil advising people how to lose weight, they're doing it out of a silent prayer to themselves. Maybe someday I'll like myself. Well, the answer is, you may get to a certain size and you still may not like yourself.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, because the not liking may or may not be associated with the body. But I think what you're telling us, which was, I suppose, so alarming and so disturbing, is that no body place has felt right for you. And that this feels less worse, but that it doesn't. And nobody was able to help you with the notion of how might you feel that you're in the right body for you, right? And I just wonder, do you know how? Do you have to control your peeing, do you kind of just do that spontaneously when it's convenient?
Hold on a second. Let's bring him back on. Ken, are you still with us?
Hello.
Hi. Yeah.
Hello.
Can you ask your question again, Susan?
Okay, this is a very odd question, Ken. But it seems to me that very ordinary physical activities that emanate from your body, like appetite, like hunger, like peeing. Do you know when you need to pee, or do you do that by regulation?
I'm sorry. Do you mean going to the restroom?
Yeah.
You mean?
Yeah. Urinating.
Oh,
we're allowed to say
that
on air, aren't we?
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I wasn't sure. Yeah, I was just thinking, did she just say peeing on the radio?
Yeah, she did. It wasn't a four-letter word. It's a normal function. We all do.
No. I'm sorry. I've never been asked this on the radio. Anyway, I know. the answer is I've come up with a way of regulating my eating, you know, in a way that that psychologically I'm comfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
So I do. I mean, I don't do anything unusual. I'm not anorexic. I don't have any eating problems. It hasn't solved the underlying issue is what should I look like? I went to actually, you might be interested in knowing this, I went to a personal trainer and I put this to the trainer.
Mm.
I said, what should I look like? And he didn't have any idea either.
Mm-hmm. And what's your reaction when you look at yourself if you see a little bit of a video of yourself?
Well, of course it's more of an empathy. I mean, to do what I've done, you have to have empathy for yourself as opposed to self-hatred.
Right, but when you see this, how you are now, Do you recognize yourself, or do you think, oh, this is a facsimile person pretending to be a person?
It took a couple of years before I was able to recognize myself as a skinny person.
Yeah, but when you say, I don't know what body I should have, is it like the body type you had when before you were large, or is it like a entirely different body type that you do not recognize?
Oh, I am unrecognizable. Mm. I'm unrecognizable, yeah.
And there's nobody in your family who kind of has that body type, or that you can have some continuity or some emotional connection to?
I had a father who was very thin, but going back on my mother's side for 100 years, there are letters talking about how overweight they are.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother was struck with it, had that issue. Everybody in my family on the other side, on my mother's side, they all have these problems. They all have weight problems.
So, mm-hmm. Susie, how does Ken figure out what he should look like, whether he asks himself or someone else? How does he figure out what the right answer is?
Well, I don't think there is a right answer, but I think he's embarked on something where he's trying to look after himself in a different way, and he seems to have that physical eating in a way that is okay for him. The question is, he hasn't really learned to get to know this body. He's just accepted it because it's taken him a couple of years, but he has accepted it. So I think probably not through rigorous physical exercise, but being very mindful of the various physical activities that the body engages in, whether it's walking or whether it's, you know, how you feel when you're eating, or what it's like if you go swimming, or what it's like when you're peeing, or what it's like when the sun is on your body, is a way of trying to introduce yourself to this incredibly important physical, sensational aspect of yourself, rather than be frightened of it. Because it sounds as though you've had to sort of build something for yourself, but actually you haven't moved in there yet.
We have an email from Eric in Arlington who says, I am somewhat hairy, but not excessively so. When I grew up, no one thought it was unsightly. Now my son, who is 12, is worried what he's going to look like in a few years. Can you comment on the relatively new trend for men to be hair-free on their bodies?
Yeah, I mean, it is a trend, isn't it? And I can identify, because I remember my son being alarmed himself and me thinking, oh, my God, this is they are doing to boys what they did to women for all these centuries. There's millions and millions and trillions of pounds to be made by getting young men to wax themselves. And hopefully the aesthetic will broaden, because the problem with our current ideas of attractiveness and beauty is not that we shouldn't aspire to it, but that it comes only in one package. And so we have to have these shiny chests that have no hair on it. Could we reject that? Could you fight with the men's magazines to try and represent masculinity in greater variety? Because we don't just come in one way.
Why do you think we need to oversimplify this? Why can't there be a really gorgeous, very hairy man standing next to a really gorgeous, hairless man?
I couldn't agree with you more. But if you look at photography and the moving image over the last period of time, the aesthetic has become more and more sort of pre-adolescent with attitude, hasn't it? Whether it's for girls or boys. And that's hair-free.
And we haven't even talked about the fact that women are expected to be hair-free in our culture.
Yeah, didn't they have a whole thing last month, Hairy February?
I certainly know my daughter
was involved in that.
And was that a rejection of shaving and things like that?
Yeah.
By
women? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it was probably caused by being a student and not having enough money to do all of those things. But nevertheless, it was, can we dare to have the hairs that are part of what it means to be female and to be male? But we do have to challenge these images, because I can walk past a bus stop in New York City or in London and see an image of masculinity where all of the hair from the chest has been removed, and then whatever strays are airbrushed or digitally taken out, just like what's happened with girls' freckles or any kind of perceived blemish. And since when did hair become a blemish? I mean, it is not illegal to have hair.
We have an email from Jim in Arlington who says, wants to comment on something that he knows that you must be aware of, that it's not just a female issue. He has been a skinny man all his life, and he says, it's absolutely painful for me to take my shirt off in public because I don't look like the underwear ads. The stereotypes for men are just as unrealistic as for women.
Yeah, I abhor the efforts to give men the same rotten solutions that women have been given, which is to transform their difficulties, the ordinary difficulties of living, through transforming them into body problems. And some guys come small and some guys come large. And I don't mean that in relation to genitals. I mean that in relation to all aspects of self. And they're probably all as interesting as we women are, too. So it's outrageous that men are being targeted with this stuff.
Why do we believe so thoroughly in the possibility of transformation?
Well, I think there's a lot of different ways we could think that. One is because it is a profit-driven industry, isn't it? I mean, if you can transform your body, you can put a lot of money into the coffers of cosmetic surgeons and diet companies and gyms and the rest of it. I think at another level, the images we see suggest that look is a surface and look is something transformative. I think if you take seriously my point that our bodies have been destabilized and insecure, then the attraction to a kind of unitary image, which is very, very similar across all brands and across the globe, becomes attractive because it looks like a pole of certainty to which one could, if one gravitated, one could feel more secure about one's own body.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We will take more of your calls right after this break. My guest is Susie Orbach. She's a psychotherapist and co-founder of the Women's Therapy Center in London and New York. Her latest book is called Bodies. Again, you can join us after the break by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is co-founder of the Women's Therapy Centers in London and in New York, Susie Orbach. Her new book is called Bodies. Let's go back to the phone now and speak with Charles in Denton. Hi, Charles.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Go ahead, please.
Okay, I have a question about how women and men react to their own gender when they see it depicted in art, mm-hmm. or how artists depict their gender. You can tell from a woman artist, I think, in general, and a man artist, how when they paint a woman, you see that they do it a different style, depending on their viewpoint. But what's interesting to me is that I'll post my work online or something, and of a woman, and almost every negative comment I get are from women, but they'll see something small in there that they think is wrong. But I was wondering if women have a tendency more to compare themselves with women in art than what men do.
That's
so interesting. I think my answer off the air.
I mean, I wish I had a screen and I could bring up your art so I could know what they was responding to. Of course, I think we do respond differently to artistic representations of the body. And I think also artists are really trying to, I mean, I've written quite a lot in Bodies about artists and how they're depicting the body today and what they're trying to tell us about the body's integrity and the difficulty of seeing the body as a body rather than just as a surface that needs to be worked on. But I'd have to look at your work to be able to respond in an intelligent way, I'm afraid.
You know, one thing that's really interesting are these projects where they take, you know, 1,000 people and at a given time everyone takes off their clothes.
Oh, yeah, his stuff, Tronic's work, yeah.
Yeah, and what's really remarkable is that after a while, all of them start to look alike. You really don't sit there and focus on every flaw. They begin to really seem much more similar than they are different.
Yeah, I mean, I think the whole notion of flaw is something we need to jettison because it's about individuality, isn't it? It's about the uniqueness. And if you go to a nudist beach, for example, which I used to do not because I was a particular nudist fan, but just because it happened to be the beach near where we went hiking in Austria years ago, and what was really fascinating for me as somebody who wasn't a nudist aficionado was that for the first 10 or 15 minutes, I'd be completely fascinated by everybody's body. And then I kind of just sort of took their bodies like their smiles in a way. It was just a part of them rather than those breasts hang down, that penis does this, that butt does that. It was actually very, very refreshing. It was like being in a sauna for a very long time, or a Turkish bath, if you could sustain it for long enough to get beyond the evaluative moment and to get into being really interested and curious about people's bodies.
Did your sense of your own nudity vanish at about the same time?
That's an interesting question. I don't know. I think for me it was more when I had children, because actually your body is doing something very dramatic when you have children, when you have babies.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And it's a moment of potential respect for the place you live that is so overwhelming. And you are seen by nurses or doctors or midwives or whoever you're having your baby with, where what's important is not how your body looks, but what your body can produce. And I think that was a really salient factor for me in feeling that step along further of comfort with my own body.
Let's go next on the phone to Paula in Dallas. Hello, Paula.
Hello, ladies. I have a 7-year-old daughter who is coming home with negative comments about her body even at this young age. Mm. And this is happening despite our efforts, you know, to eliminate things that we feel promote this sort of thing. And so it's just seeping in anyway. And I'm wondering what else I can do as a female and as her mother to help her have a healthy body image.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really, really difficult. And I think it's a question of developing a bit of an antiviral agent, right, at home. Because you can't say to them it doesn't matter, because that's what they're going to think you're idiots, because it does matter at school. Right? And I suppose what I did, and I don't know if this could be helpful to you, is that I was certainly still bathing my daughter at 7 or 8 and chatting to her in the bath at 8 and 9. And I would definitely say to her, you know, I wonder whether you're going to have my breasts or grandma's breasts or grandma on daddy's side or great grandma's or auntie so-and-so's, da da da. So I would kind of relate to the body and its unfolding as a moment of curiosity and excitement rather than as a pre-given that it was supposed to come in one way. And sort of talking to her about how lucky she was to have a baby tummy, because that was the only time she was ever going to have it in life, because that's a very special kind of tummy that you have at 7 and 8. And talking about all the wonderful things that bodies can do, but just kind of dropping it into the conversation and talking about, isn't Margot, who was Amazonian and, you know, 3 times the size of my daughter, isn't she magnificent? And isn't that Livy so adorably petite? So I kind of talk about the different bodies that my daughter was playing with as having really lovely attributes that I believed, it wasn't phony, that we could both enjoy and take pleasure in together. And we'd kind of joke about the dolls and how lovely it was to dress dolls in clothes, and how funny it was that dolls didn't grow up like people did, because people's bodies were changing all the time. So we did all sorts of those kinds of conversations.
I think a lot of mothers now, Susie, have absorbed the advice that it certainly is detrimental to our daughters and probably to our sons as well, to stand in front of the mirror and criticize our bodies. But I wonder if people are being encouraged enough to look in the mirror inside of their kids and say, boy, I really love my nose, or I really like my hair. Is it enough to just not criticize yourself in front of your kids?
Well, I think it's both, right? I mean, I think just like you say, oh, you've got Uncle Lawrence's temper, or you've got his or her artistic bent, you could say, and you're so lucky to have that nose.
Mm-hmm.
Or those little cheeks. Those cheeks seem to be just yours. I don't know where you got them from, because nobody has cheeks as gorgeous as that, right? See, I think all of that is really quite interesting for children, because, and also that they change, right? Because my children now look sort of very much like each other, and they didn't. Well, they did when they were babies, and they didn't, and that they do again now that they're in their 20s, right? And my daughter used to look exactly like me, and my son used to look exactly like his dad, right? Now, it's a really interesting adventure as you talk about their own individuality and the way their faces morph and change and develop. And I think if you can get them to have that kind of view of their body, it's a lot better than the static view that they're being encouraged to have with their peers.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Carrollton, and we have Bea on the line. Hi, Bea.
Hello. I so appreciate the wisdom and insight about bodies and what you just had to say about children. I would appreciate hearing some about dealing with the guilt around bodies that is a result of survivors of incest. Mm. I am both a psychotherapist for 30 years and personally was incested as a young child, and have dealt with myself in therapy for many, many years, all of the hatred for my body.
I mean, and I think that's a very, very special case, right? Because what one sees, I'll say as a psychotherapist here, because I'm talking to a psychotherapist, is that what maybe you've experienced and many of the people you've worked with have experienced is the hate of the abuser that gets dumped on you and gives you the sense of your body that has let you down because you couldn't resist them because there was no way. And on top of that, you've had to absorb the hate that they have towards their body. Does that make any sense?
Hang on. Let's bring B back. B, does that ring true for you?
I'm sorry?
Does that ring true, what Susie was just saying?
Oh, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
And also, go
on.
Would you talk about some ways to specifically help people forgive the body? It's one thing to forgive the perpetrator, to forgive whatever.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose it's a question of unraveling the knitting, isn't it? So if you give back the violence to the perpetrator, you don't take it on because you were the violated one, right? But you always feel that you're the one at fault. But if you can give in your own mind, you reassign in your own mind the violence back. You could also reassign the hate back to a certain extent. Now, that might leave you with a very vulnerable body. Right? But vulnerable can be cared for. Hate, it's very, very hard to assuage or look after. So I suppose it's finding the space to underpin that vulnerability and to notice it and to regard it. I mean, it's a kind of a more technical question than I can deal with on air, but I definitely understand what you're talking about.
I wonder, Susie, how often the patients who come to you for things that are ostensibly not related to their bodies, how often they instantly recognize it when you tell them that you think they might have some work to do as well on how they view their body?
Well, I don't usually do that because I'm the kind of shrink that doesn't say a lot. I mean, I do because you wouldn't hear me talking now.
But do people see this in themselves, or do they sort of think that's a problem everybody else has?
No, they see it in themselves.
Mm-hmm. Are we all complicit in creating this culture?
Absolutely. I'm not in creating, but yes, we are part of it because that we're not passive, right? This is the world we live in, and we engage in the territory that the world gives us. So it's impossible not to be implicit. Right? I mean, The question is, how do we create a little bit of space between jumping in? I mean, let's take a ridiculous example. Like, you know, they brought out a mascara with a twirl in it, right? It automatically twirls.
Mm-hmm.
I'm no less vulnerable than the next person thinking, what a great idea. And then I have to say to myself, wait a minute, what are they offering me? A battery-operated mascara? This is really, what, because my hand can't move? This is going to solve the problem to my life? So I have a chuckle about the mascara.
Well, and it's interesting because at the moment that you're there making that impulse purchase, it seems like not a big deal. It's $8 and maybe you'll like it and you don't think about it.
Maybe it'll be really a source of pleasure for you.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But the pleasure is in thinking that there is something there that's absolutely lovely for you. It's not actually in the object.
What do you suggest people do who are beginning to cope with these issues? Do they clean all the magazines out of the house? Do they stop watching movies? What do you say?
Well, you know, we have a wonderful website they could have a look at. It's any-body.org. And you might want to put that on your website if you could.
We will put that on the website.
It's really lovely, and people can look at that. They can post things on it. There are so many places we could start. If you're young mums, you could club together to talk about how to not pass on your own body difficulties to the next generation. If you're teachers, you could talk about helping your classrooms not to articulate emotions rather than turn them into body problems. There's all sorts of material around that people can use. I think it's perfectly okay to write to magazines and say, could you please produce images that are more diverse so that we can recognize ourselves in these magazines? I think you could prosecute the local diet companies in your area for you know, I don't know what it's called, but they certainly do break the Trade Descriptions Act in England because they offer something that they don't deliver at all.
They'll say on the bottom, results not typical.
Sorry?
There's always a disclaimer on the bottom that says results not typical, where you see that photograph of someone who's, you know, taking
off. Right, but even if it doesn't say that, it says diets will help you lose weight.
Yeah.
But that ain't true. Diet, all the evidence shows that while a diet in the short term may help you lose weight, the diet in the long term will make you put on weight, right? If diets worked, you'd only have to do them once. So they depend upon a failure rate. 90% failure rate.
Have you seen a change in the willingness of mental health professionals to always or at least often address body image in conjunction with whatever more obvious issues patients do have?
No, because I do think that, sadly, because eating problems and body dysmorphias are so widespread now, it's almost like a career track for therapists to study it, which, you know, it's a double-edged sword. You want people to be more aware of it, but at the same time, you don't want it only to be the only focus. So I've seen more willingness, but I'm not more willingness, but I'm not sure that I see necessarily massive amounts of intelligence brought to it.
Susie Orbach is a psychotherapist. You can find her website at any-body.org. Her newest book is called Bodies. Susie, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for spending it. My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.